And this is Studio 2. Welcome on in. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And we're saying welcome.
We're really welcoming.
Welcoming people in.
Big time.
Big time. And on YouTube.
Visually welcoming them in.
For the very first time.
This is what we look like.
I know.
Didn't know.
Hi, guys.
There comes the voice. I love the voice.
And so today, Studio 2 is streaming live on YouTube for the very first time. And hopefully this will be a regular thing. This is going to be a regular thing.
It will be.
Yeah.
You always say to manifest things.
Manifest
it. It will be. We had a very clever listener. Mm-hmm. I want to give her credit. Her name's
Shout
Ellen,
her out.
Ellen, yes. Tracy Lindner, who said, if Studio 2 is on YouTube, should it be called Studio Tube?
Tube.
And then the people who watch could be Studio Tubers.
I love that.
But it does make them sound like potatoes.
Because
a tuber is a potato.
Yeah, yeah.
So we'll workshop that. For now, hello to our Studio Tubers.
Hi, guys.
And potatoes all around the world.
Yes.
And welcome into Studio 2 on the radio and on YouTube. And now let's talk about what we're talking about today on the show, Cherry.
Yeah, we're talking about the link between alcohol consumption and cancer. Full disclosure, I like champagne.
Yes.
And I like to
You're
drink
not
it.
Alone in that.
I like to drink it on a regular basis. Not all the time, but semi-regular.
Are you drinking it right now?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
I'm drinking water.
Just want to make sure what's in there.
But, you know, we probably all heard that the U.S. Surgeon General has recommended that there be a new label on alcohol bottles now that warns people about this link between cancer and alcohol. I honestly was part of the 55% of Americans who did not specifically know that drinking alcohol, any amount, could increase your risk.
Yeah, you associate it with poor health, especially lots of drinking, but that's not the first thing that comes to mind for most people.
It does not, and it does not. And so we do what we do here on Studio 2. We brought in some experts. They're going to be talking to us about this link. We're going to look at the research. We're going to ask a lot of questions. And our question for you, our listeners, is will the Surgeon General's warnings about alcohol push you to change your habits? Would you cut back, right? What's the best way to influence large-scale change? And what do you think about the pros and cons of drinking? You can participate in a multitude of ways. You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're on YouTube, you can comment right there on the page, and our producers will be monitoring all those comments. And you might hear your comment on the show.
Yeah, you're a Studio Tuber. Leave that comment. I think it's catching on.
It's catching on, Jerry.
So for those that don't know, we start every show before we get into our big topic with a trio of local news stories. Mm-hmm. We're cheating a little bit today because the first story is not really a local news story. But since we're on, you know, YouTube for the first time, this is a social media related story. We did want to start by talking about the big news this morning that Meta, which owns Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, will get rid of its third-party fact-checkers, introduce community notes like you see on X, and boost political content. We have a clip now from the video statement that Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg posted online. You've heard of him, Mark Zuckerberg. Okay. He describes why the company is pivoting away from the idea of using third-party fact-checkers. Let's play the clip.
After Trump first got elected in 2016, the legacy media wrote nonstop about how misinformation was a threat to democracy. We tried in good faith to address those concerns without becoming the arbiters of truth. But the fact-checkers have just been too politically biased and have destroyed more trust than they've created, especially in the U.S.
Okay. There you have it, straight from the horse's mouth.
Yeah.
So this is a big change in the world of social media. Obviously, Meta is massive. So anything that they do has a big effect on the whole ecosystem.
Yeah. Well, to me, this pivot is not a surprise because Meta gave $1 million to President-elect Donald Trump's inaugural fund after, you know, CEO Zuckerberg traveled to Mar-a-Lago to meet with Trump. And now we hear this announcement. I'll note that Zuckerberg also said in some of his remarks that this means, quote, we're going to catch less bad stuff, but we'll also reduce innocent people's posts and accounts that we accidentally take down.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, we poll a lot on Facebook. And anytime I would post anything that was related to race or anything controversial, people wouldn't really see it. So I had less comments.
Yeah.
So the good news is
it'll be throttled down.
Yeah, it'll be throttled down. The good news is more of that may be seen. The bad news is it's going to require the public and users to actually police misinformation and disinformation. And you and I know we did a whole show on this.
We did indeed.
Once a lie is out there, it's hard to get it back in the bottle.
Yeah. I'm as much interested in boosting political content, that side of it, mm-hmm. as the fact-checking side of it. I mean, that's going to be a sea change for Facebook.
Yeah.
Because right now, what you're fed is like photos of cats. I mean, it's really, it's changed so much. Mm-hmm. And I'll be interested to see how much it changes back. Second story now in our trio, Cherry. Tell us about it.
Yes. The new two-year session of Pennsylvania's House starts today. And the Democrats...
Welcome back, House.
Yeah. Welcome back. And the Democrats had a one-seat majority in the House, but it's now in jeopardy because one member is out sick. And that member is Democratic State Representative Matthew Gurley. He suffered a medical emergency during the holiday break, and he'll be out for some period of time. This means that the Pennsylvania House is tied 101 members to 101 members.
So they go to overtime after they tie, right?
After they tie. I don't know what they do over there. But it probably won't be a major issue this session because he is expected to come back. But today, first day, there's the vote on the House Speaker by the full chamber. And then there's vote on rules for the two-year session, including what committees people are on and all those sorts of things. And the impact is that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, Avi, will need to get people in the opposition to agree with them in order to get anything done. So it's going to be some tension, I assume, in the negotiation rooms.
Yeah, for those that haven't been following the state house, it's been like this for a while. This is now the second cycle in which there will be this exactly one-seat majority in favor of the Democrats. Such a sort of strange place to be in two sessions in a row. I mean, what are the chances? But look, there's a lot of business.
It's a lot to be done.
That could happen in Harrisburg this session. We've got transit funding, marijuana legalization, of course, the budget every year. So we'll see how much this impacts the way business gets done in Harrisburg, if business gets done in Harrisburg.
Yeah, and what's so interesting is, you know, the Senate is run by Republicans. The Pennsylvania Senate is run by Republicans. And so having the House be run by Democrats puts our governor, Josh Shapiro, in a better position for negotiation purposes. Sure. And so the longer that this state representative stays out,
all that stuff,
you know, it makes it more just a little tougher for the governor to get his agenda done. So we'll see what happens.
Let's wind down the round up.
Yes.
By headed to New Jersey. Mm-hmm. And we saw something, NJ.com, that just caught our eye. Mm-hmm. Just delighted us.
A little bit.
It's actually written by a former guest on our show, Peter Genovese, who wrote... Remember Peter?
Yeah. I remember Peter.
He wrote a column titled The Seven Wonders of New Jersey.
Okay.
You know, there's like seven wonders of the ancient world, the pyramid, the hanging gardens, whatever.
And of course, Jersey has to have its own wonders.
He didn't really say what qualifies for a wonder, which I love. Just leave it open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So according to Peter, the seven wonders of New Jersey are the BAPS... the large temple in Robbinsville, New Jersey, which is massive.
Yeah, it's magnificent.
It is magnificent. Yeah. The Bayway Refinery, don't know much about that.
Don't know that.
Camden City Hall.
Yeah.
The Great Falls in Paterson, New Jersey. Shout out Paterson. My grandmother was from Paterson.
Okay.
High Point State Park in Montague. The Pine Barrens, of course, one of the great wonders of New Jersey. And the Pulaski Skyway. I only know like three of those, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I can't say. I don't know much
about that.
Feel bad.
But it did get us thinking.
Uh-huh.
What are the seven wonders of Pennsylvania?
That's a good question. And of course, you asked it today.
I put it to the group, the Studio 2 team, and this is what we came up with. I mean, look, I made the ultimate decision on the seven wonders of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And again, we don't really know what the criteria are for wonder.
You made it up. We made it up. Yes. Wonders.
Yeah. Okay. Falling Water, the Frank Lloyd masterpiece out in Western PA.
All right.
The Grand Canyon of Pennsylvania.
Ooh. What is that?
I don't know. Kevin McCory said it had to be on the list. I don't know.
EP
I don't
says
know.
Says we okay, executive producer. Yes.
Yeah,
we agree.
He's the boss. Sure. Grand Canyon of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Hershey Park, the whole Hershey complex.
I love Hershey.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
So nice.
There's
out there.
The voice again.
Sorry.
I love the voice. No, I'm encouraging the voice. I cheated and put like Liberty Bell Independence Hall as one.
It is a wonder.
It's a wonder.
Mm-hmm.
The Altoona Curve. Do you know about the Altoona Curve?
I do not. I've never been to Altoona. I got to go out there.
Yeah. It's this really cool, it's like an engineering feat because there's part of the railway that does this really dramatic curve in Altoona, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
What did I miss? I put Centralia, PA, which is a wonder in sort of a bad way.
Okay.
That's the place where there's this, there's a fire burning underground in the mine shafts, and they've never been able to put it out.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a wonder, though. And I also put the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the PMA.
I agree.
You know what's not on the list?
What?
Anything from Pittsburgh.
Oh, they feel shafted right now. Sorry, Pittsburgh folks.
I was like, what should I put from Pittsburgh? They have bridges, the yellow bridges of Pittsburgh. Is that a wonder? There's bridges
everywhere.
It is pretty
nice. We were out there bridges everywhere, this September. CJ. It's pretty nice, though. But you're not impressed
by those
bridges. I
love Pittsburgh. There's just
no
wonders for me. I think one part of the city, there's like a tram that goes up something, like a really steep hillside. Is that a wonder?
I mean, I got to spend more time in Pittsburgh to really answer that question.
If you disagree, Studio Tubers, if you disagree, let us know in the comments. Coming up, we're going to get to our main segment all about the link between alcohol and cancer and what should be done about alcohol consumption in this country. If you've got thoughts, email us, studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. According to the research, alcohol increases the risk of cancer. And we're not just talking about problem drinkers, people who struggle with alcohol dependency, or binge drink at college parties. If you consider yourself a moderate drinker, you have a glass here or there with dinner, the health risks may apply to you too. And the link is so strong that Surgeon General Vivek Murthy is now calling for cancer warning labels. Here he is on PBS NewsHour on Friday. Let's take a listen. All right. Well, basically,
he says the Surgeon General's warning on alcohol bottles, which currently warns people about drinking while they're pregnant and about driving or operating heavy machinery after having, alcohol. And those two things have actually soaked into, the general understanding of what we shouldn't do with alcohol. People should know about the cancer risk as well.
But alcohol is so deeply ingrained in how we connect socially. The ads are hard to escape. It's convenient to buy. And most Americans are not aware of the true risks associated with drinking. It's been close to 100 years since Prohibition failed. But experts say it's about time we do something to regulate the powerful alcohol industry.
It will likely be difficult to do, but could the Surgeon General's warning, along with a rise in sober, curious lifestyles and more non-alcoholic options, push Americans away from drinking? We're going to talk about the research and potential policy solutions for the rest of the hour with two great guests. We have David Jernigan, a professor of health, law, policy, and management at Boston University, joining us via Zoom. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Luis Ceja, a postdoctoral fellow with the National Clinician Scholars Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Luis, welcome to Studio 2.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
And as always, we want you, our listeners, to answer our questions today. Will the Surgeon General's warnings about alcohol push you to change your habits? Maybe you're already drinking less, or maybe you want to. What do you think about the pros and cons of drinking? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching via YouTube, you can comment right on the website.
Speaking of YouTube, Miles says alcohol has a lot of benefits that are understudied.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Luis, help us out. When you give like your elevator pitch to people, they say, Luis, like, what does alcohol actually do to your body over a long period of time? How does it affect you? What's sort of like the 30, 60 second explanation for what alcohol does to us?
Sure, absolutely. So just to preface, I am an internist and a pediatrician. I am an aspiring transplant hepatologist, meaning that I want to give everyone a liver transplant that needs one. And the leading cause of liver transplants right now in the United States is alcohol-associated liver disease. So that also intersects with alcohol use disorder. And one of the reasons why I'm also like here today and, you know, really involved with the alcohol policy space and kind of exploring the different options that we can do. I think the Surgeon General's announcement and advisory warning has been a long time coming, something that we've really needed. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of undercommunication about the dangers of alcohol in general.
Like, give me an example. Yeah. Like, what do you think people generally don't understand?
That it is so permeated in our society. And it's not just like, you know, cancer, for example. For me, it is, I recently wrote a piece, a commentary piece that came out in Stat News. And as a doctor, there's just so many reasons that alcohol just plays a part. It is the thing that we see in so many social histories.
Yeah.
The thing in chronic diseases, not just like liver disease or cancer, for example, but it is the things that brings people in. It is the drunk driving, for example. There was also, I remember I trained in New York and I was at the 34th Street stop, and it was during the basketball championships. There were a party just had come down. They were drunk and they were stumbling down the steps.
Wow.
And when you think about it, it was not, they stumbled down the steps and there was a girl that actually her cell phone slipped into the tracks itself.
Yeah.
But she did not have the awareness to be like, oh, let me pause. And she tried to jump into the tracks.
Wow.
And so when we think about alcohol, it's not just like those acute effects, like I'm drunk right now, but it's also what it does to our brain. And we're not thinking straight. Yeah. We are going to be drunk driving. I'm going to jump headfirst into the train tracks to get my cell phone while there's a train coming. You know, we're not thinking right. But when we think about the mechanisms itself, about what alcohol actually does, it is what we call a carcinogen, meaning that there's a direct link to cancer as well. So ETOH, ethyl alcohol, it metabolizes into something what we call acetaldehyde. And that's what actually disrupts DNA repair and all these things at the cellular level that help contribute to cancer as well.
Mm. Yeah. And David, I want to bring you into the conversation. And Luis started to tell us some of this, but can you specifically walk us through what alcohol does to your body that makes you at a higher risk to get cancer?
Through some of it, certainly the DNA damage. It also eases the entry of carcinogens from tobacco. So if you're smoking and drinking at the same time, then that will increase your risk. But also the larger picture here, to more than 200 disease and injury conditions in the human body, actually kills 178,000 people a year in the U.S. It is the third most preventable cause of cancer, tobacco, and obesity. It's kind of a no-brainer. Since 1988, we've known, and the International Agency Research on Cancer has determined that alcohol was a carcinogen, cancers of the mouth, esophagus, larynx, liver, colorectal area, female breast, seven sites where it's a clear carcinogen. And the message here, and it's so great that the Surgeon General has spoken out. I mean, the general message here is if you want to reduce your risk of cancer, the less you drink, the better.
Yeah.
Well, so I think most people, if you just ask someone on the street, David, they would say alcohol's not good for you. But we talked about this earlier on the show. They might not say that cancer. Alcohol is linked to cancer. Mm-hmm. So if that connection is made in mass for lots of people, how do you think that changes the way the average person approaches the risk? Because cancer is a different type of risk than I'm going to wake up tomorrow not feeling great because I'm hungover. How do you think it changes people's risk appraisal if they're making that connection between alcohol and cancer?
I think cancer scares people big time.
Yeah.
Cancer is a hidden disease. It develops slowly over time. You know, it kind of wears away at your body, and when it finally shows up, for many people, it may be too late for effective treatment. So it really scares people. I think, frankly, this is what one of the things the alcohol industry is most worried about here. In tobacco, we began with the warnings, and even though the research we've got on alcohol warnings suggests they're not going to make that much of a difference and people's drinking behavior, they are the opening wedge. We do have one pilot study from a cancer done in one province in Canada. They could only study it for about 6 weeks because the alcohol industry protested so loudly they had to stop the study. But already they were seeing measurable effects in people's alcohol purchasing behavior. So yes, the cancer warning alone may make some difference, but it also designates alcohol as not a regular consumer product as particularly bad for you. And that may open the way to some of the other things where it's much clearer that they affect people's behavior. The number one here is alcohol taxes.
Yeah.
Most states stopped raising their alcohol taxes in 1972. They generally flat taxes. They don't rise with inflation. The result is alcohol has gotten still lower in the alcohol industry. Every year there's inflation, the industry gets a tax cut. We don't. So alcohol gets cheaper and cheaper. One of the little exercises I love to do, I lived in Baltimore for 10 years, go to a corner store, figure out the cheapest form of liquid is. It's not the soda pop, it's not the water, it's not the orange juice, it's not the milk, it's the beer.
And I want to make sure that I get the question of the day out to our listeners. Would a warning label about risk of cancer linked to alcohol push you to change your habits? What is the best way to influence large-scale change? How do you think, what do you think about the pros and cons of drinking? What are those for you? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Matt from Norristown comments, warning labels on alcohol might help him cut back. He says, my alcohol consumption has dropped quite a bit over the past 10 or 15 years anyway. And Luis, I want to bring you back in the conversation. And one of the things that stood out to me from David and just in preparing for the show was that this is something that is not new information, although I did not know this weeks ago. You know what I mean? Why do you think this is, this information has been out there about this link to cancer, between, you know, alcohol and cancer? And why isn't this more widely known? And why hasn't, you know, this warning been provided to consumers years ago?
Sure. I think the pandemic, COVID, really changed the game for a lot of different reasons and brought a lot of attention to things that we weren't paying attention to before. You know, and the pandemic itself made alcohol use a lot worse. So, for example, as I said, I trained in New York City. We had a governor. We had a governor in New York that deemed liquor stores essential businesses. We had DoorDash and Uber Eats that were able to, like, deliver liquor straight to your doorstep. And, you know, from my experience, my clinical experience, we had young people that were my age that were drinking themselves to transplant. And then you have, you know, a broader society that's just like, oh, I need, how am I going to cope? I'm isolated. Let me just drink. And so we developed really unhealthy drinking habits during the pandemic. And then we saw the rise. You know, it used to be 150,000 or so deaths related to alcohol. And then the pandemic started. Now we're around 178, as David had said, 178,000 deaths per year. And so alcohol has been getting a lot of attention, not just in the U.S., but also internationally. And when we think about the labeling, you know, we're not the first to call for this. You know, in Ireland last year, they made a big statement in saying, hey, we're going to go ahead and start putting this cancer risk on all our labeling. There is a lot of pushback saying that from the different markets, saying this is going to impact us economically. There's competing priorities all over the place. But Ireland said the public health benefits outweigh the risk.
You have some props with you, by the way. Kudos to you, Luis, for bringing
us in
on our first YouTube day.
You
so I'm guessing that you wanted to show us what the existing labels look like on bottles of alcohol. So what do you have here?
So I have a 50 milliliter shot little bottle of Fireball. So
when, it's a whiskey,
Yes. And so whenever you buy alcohol within the United States, wherever it's sold, there is a government label warning. So, for example,
can you read it without reading glasses is the question.
Not this one.
And can you read that one? That's a clear bottle.
Yes.
So.
This is a Corona now.
Yes. So we have two. I'll read it verbatim. It says, one, according to the Surgeon General, women should not drink alcoholic beverage during pregnancy because of the risk of birth defects. And two, consumption of alcoholic beverages impairs your ability to drive a car or operate machinery and may cause health problems.
May cause health problems.
And again, as David had alluded to, we did not start getting alcohol label warnings until 1988, and these have not been updated for over 30 years.
Wow.
As compared to tobacco, the Surgeon General's report that came out in 1964 said, hey, we have to do something. And then in 1965 is when we started seeing labels on tobacco.
And that's pack of Newports here.
Oh, yes. And for example, taxes and prices, like price increases, do work. This was $16.
Yeah,
for that one pack of Newports.
Yes, this was like less than two.
The Fireball whiskey.
You could take a shot. Yeah.
Yeah.
For less than $2.
Yeah. And then both of these were just under $5, for example.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the warning on the Newports, what does that say in comparison?
So it's interesting. So there has been a lot of development and evolution of the labeling, especially within the last like 5 years or so for this. I was kind of disappointed because I was expecting a little bit more, but what it does say is the Surgeon General warning on the pack of Newport says, quitting smoking now greatly reduces serious risk to your health. What we now have from the FDA is that we actually now have graphic images. They're investing like almost like 3D color images showing the direct effects. They have 11 different models that you can go through. So there's actually the most fascinating one was actually one of a woman with like a big like cancerous like tumor like coming out of her neck. They're really trying to like drive home this point that smoking causes cancer. And they're doing it through every which way. And they're making sure that it's going to be visible. When you look at the visibility of what we have on alcohol, again, it's clear, right?
Yeah.
The moment that this is down, you don't do it. You think it might just be like nutritional facts. You might not even do
it. I thought
it
was ingredients.
No, exactly. Yeah. And so when we think about labeling too, it's not just about the warning, but it's about the placement. It's about the color. How big is it? Where are we going to put it? And what is actually going to do? What's going to drive these behavior changes?
It's so interesting because this morning preparing for the show, I went and looked at my bar. I have a bar at home. Mm-hmm. And I picked up a bottle of tequila and there was the label, but I could not read it because it was clear.
Exactly.
And the lettering wasn't done in a way that stood out. So it was really, really hard to read. And so, you know, David, I want to bring you back into the conversation and sort of talk through this because I remember back in the day, cigarettes used to be everywhere. There used to be the big camel and cartoons, sure, advertising cigarettes to kids and all sorts of things. And now, I mean, we've done shows on this. I mean, they have hard cider, all sorts of things we're seeing. Why do you think there's such, you know, widespread, you know, advertising? I mean, when you think about the culture of alcohol, it's everywhere. I mean, how do you sort of try to curb something like that that's so ubiquitous?
Well, and it's because that's exactly what the alcohol industry wants in order to their product. This is an industry that spends in excess of $1 billion a year marketing alcohol in the U.S. Story of alcohol, largely a story being told by the industry, of the Surgeon General's chance to tell the story. You all were talking about the existing label. Those last words, I call them the five dirty words and make problems. They're actually added in the back room at the last minute.
Yeah, and unfortunately,
the alcohol industry.
And yes, David,
I'm so sorry. We're still having problems with your line. We want to make sure folks can hear you. So we're going to try to get that patched up. Let's bring in a caller now.
Yeah.
On our caller line, this is line two, Keith from Central Jersey, who has a comment for us. Keith, you're on Studio 2.
Hi, just to make it really quick. Every person I know who's been a moderate or more alcohol drinker has had health problems, and specifically including colon, colorectal cancer, life-threatening cancers. And more than that, I've even offered at least some of these people the most expensive organic grape juice, and that does not do a thing for them. They are simply fixed on the alcohol. And one last really brief thing, I don't think there should be a law forbidding people to drink alcohol if they want to, but I just think people are so ill-informed about just what a poison it is.
Yeah.
Thanks so much. That was Keith from Central Jersey. And now let's bring another caller, and this is Julie from Absecon on line three, who has a question. So Julie, you're on Studio 2. And hopefully Luis will be able to field
answer
this one for
us.
Julie, are you with us? All right, Julie's not there. But let me bring in a question now from Hillary, one of our Studio Tubers. Mm-hmm. Hillary says, does science agree on whether there is a safe consumption level of alcohol? Because I do think one of the big mind shifts and sea changes here, Luis, is the idea that there might not be any safe amount of alcohol. So what does the research actually say at this point?
Yeah. And so this is where public health really needs to work on its messaging because it's very contradictory in some respects. So we have a lot of recent research as early as 2019 from the World Health Organization that had said that there is, you know, they did a huge meta-analysis, a big research study through everything that's been done up until that point. And it's been determined that there is no safe amount of alcohol that you can drink. Even this poses a risk. right? Whether that is from, you know, you are the beginnings of like a malignancy, a cancer developing, or even the stories that I shared earlier of that you're putting yourself at risk for like your own self-harm, like unknowingly, right? And then that has been proven and proven time and time again since. And, but also right now we have what we call the dietary guidelines that are done by the USDA. And they're actually right now in being rewritten for 2025 to 2030. But right now for the current USDA recommendations for drinking is that they don't recommend any heavy or like binge drinking. But if you are good to drink, there are a couple recommendations that they do have. So if you are a man, so no more than 2 drinks per day. If you're a woman, no more than 1 drink per day. But then the question becomes, how do we define what is one drink?
How many ounces is that?
No, exactly, exactly. And so there's different things that we have. So for beer, one drink is defined as 12 fluid ounces. So this is 12 fluid ounces and also a can of beer. When we look at wine, that's 5 ounces. And so 5 ounces, you can just think of that as a glass of wine. But you're going to measure with your heart.
There's giant glasses.
Yeah. And then when we look at distilled spirits, like, you know, a shot of tequila, for example, 1.5 ounces, which is exactly a shot. And even this is considered more than 1.5 ounces.
Wow. We want to bring in Julie from Epsika now, who has her question. Julie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question for our guest here?
Hi, I'm working with a COVID voice, so forgive me here. My question is, how is the data in for someone who has a few drinks on the weekend versus someone who does drink every single day?
Thank you for that.
And by the way, Julie, we hope you feel better soon.
Yeah. I've had the COVID voice myself. Go right ahead, Louise.
Sure. And so if I understood the question is, what is the difference between kind of like binge
drinker? A weekend drinker versus a daily drinker.
I think a lot of people are probably wondering, but like, how much does that extra drink add to my risk? Is there a threshold past which, you know, I'm really, really exponentially increasing my risk? Because you could say no safe amount, but that doesn't mean that these things are all equal.
And if you only drink a couple of drinks on Saturday versus and not any other day, is that safer than 1 drink a day?
Yeah. And so, again, this is where we really, as public health officials and also like as the medical profession, we have to kind of come together a consensus about what our messaging is going to be, because those are all very, very valid questions. And when we like think about it, if I'm going to brunch and the first question I ask is like, bottomless, do you offer bottomless like or not? I mean, again,
the bottomless mimosas have gotten me. So,
you know, absolutely. I mean, that poses a risk, whether that it's not necessarily chronic, but right there in that moment, if you're, you know, downing whole bottles of champagne and then going out and trying to go about your day, you're posing a risk to yourself.
Yeah. I got
to
ask you this question from Judith, who comments, a good wine is good for the heart. That's according to doctors. And we only have about a minute and a half before we go to break. But we've received messaging that wine was good for you, specifically red wine. Why are we getting these mixed messaging, and what is the actual message?
Yeah, no. So that has been debunked. So there used to be this theory that a glass of wine a day has some protective effect on your heart. That has been debunked. There was a study back in 2022 specifically that's basically debunked that. And again, it kind of comes back to this messaging that there is no safe amount of alcohol.
Lies. You've been lied to.
So we're coming up on a break pretty soon, but I want to read in a few more comments. Monique says, it's obvious from the amount of people who smoke that warning labels don't work. We have to figure out why people drink, to what extreme, and if their life is being negatively impacted by drinking. Let's put a pin in that.
Yeah, we will.
Kareem from Newcastle, Delaware says, I know the risk without a label. I'm working on a healthier lifestyle simply because I know it's the right thing to do and that nothing beneficial is in alcohol. I do love my bourbon, though. That is Kareem.
Kareem kept it real for us.
Nathaniel says, I don't drink, but I believe many Americans tend to love alcohol more than they will ever fear any consequences that result from consuming it. So on the other side of this break, let's talk about what would actually work. Because in this country, we did try a massive intervention about 100 years ago.
Prohibition.
Oh, yeah.
And people don't remember that all too fondly. So if we assume we're not going back down that road, you know, what combination of things could really move the needle here? So we're going to talk about that on the other side of the break.
Yeah, we'll also talk about the politics of it all. Looking forward to that. And we're talking about the link between alcohol and cancer and what we could do to change America's drinking habits. Call us. We'd love to hear from you, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And And you can leave a comment
on our YouTube, right on the YouTube page.
Become a studio tuber. All right, studio2 at whyy.org, 888-477-9499. We will be right back.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolf-Manert.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the health risks of alcohol and what could be done to push Americans to drink less. The U.S. Surgeon General has called for cancer labels on alcohol. And we have a guest to talk with us about all of this. We have Luis Ceja, postdoctoral fellow with the National Clinician Scholars Program at the University of Pennsylvania.
We've got calls and comments pouring in from you, and we've asked you a couple questions this hour. Will the Surgeon General's warnings about alcohol push you to change your habits? What's the best way to influence large-scale change on this topic? And what do you think about the pros and cons of drinking? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2 at whyy.org.
Yeah, I want to bring in a caller. We have Sarah from Pittsgrove on the line. Sarah, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is about how to influence the society, Americans, to drink less. And I think that just the education is a really important key factor, because I've taken to learning more since the Sober Curious movement took off, and I have children. And one day, my son asked me, why do grown-ups drink so much alcohol? And the answer really was because it's addictive. And I think that alcohol is an addictive substance, just like cigarettes, and that many people, anybody is prone to becoming addicted to it. So if there was something like a sin tax, I think that those funds should be funneled into educating the public, and not just the young kids and teenagers, but even adults, because it's to the point where if I go to a party and I'm not drinking, it's weirder and there's more of a stigma surrounding that than if I have a so-called drinking problem.
Yes. Thank you so much, Sarah. By the way, Kier from Philadelphia comments, a commercial campaign would help. I know the commercials with the woman speaking from a machine to help her trachea was a reality check, and that's referring
that's
to smoking.
Yeah.
There were so many commercials that advance the decline of cigarettes, although e-cigarettes have been on an uptick. And so I want to talk about the political will to put even this label on there. What would it take, do you think, to get this on there? Because even though the U.S. Surgeon General says we should have a cancer label when it comes to alcohol, he can't just unilaterally do that,
to
right?
After Congress, yeah. And so when we think about what we want to do, especially at the federal level, let me just back up really quick. When it comes to alcohol policy and actually implementing things, it is so decentralized. So you have the federal level, you have the state level, and then you also have like the local level as well. Every single one of those has the ability to do something about alcohol and enforce regulations, stricter regulations, looser regulations, whatever it's going to be. And the one that would actually get us the farthest in terms of like changing the national narrative about alcohol is something at the federal level. Mm-hmm. We've had the opportunity to do that for years. So the federal excise tax has not been changed since 1991, mm-hmm. for example. And a lot of the reasons for that is that the beverage industry and the lobby is so strong.
But so you bring up tax, though. Do you think that's the one that would move the needle the most? Like, if you could pick from the constellation of possibilities here, and I'm giving you, Luis, the power, you're the Congress and the executive branch and the judicial, congratulations, you would go tax first?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
So when we look at the tax, a federal excise tax specifically, it is estimated right now that the harm done from alcohol-related harm and injury in 2010 from the Congressional Budget Office, it was $250 billion. When it was adjusted for inflation in 2022, it was up to $323 billion. And so when we have that extra like revenue, for example, we can reallocate that into education programs, to target campaigns, to treatment for alcohol use disorder, and all these different things. And we know that those work. And we also know that taxes work. We've seen it with tobacco. We've seen it with sweetened beverages, like, for example. All these things work.
They reduce consumption.
Yes.
Yeah.
In mass. So that's where you would start. You would start with tax. What else would be part of the strategy?
Yeah.
We're not going back to prohibition, I assume. We're not. Do you agree with that?
Prohibition was a well-intentioned failure.
Yeah.
And so the goal is, they wanted to eliminate it, but the goal is to regulate it.
Yeah.
And so
what other regulations could be out there? Is it like where you can get it? Because in Pennsylvania, it's actually kind of harder.
You can get it in
grocery. But it's harder than some other states to get it.
Yeah, I mean, that's
true. You do
true.
Have to go to a state-run store to get a lot of stuff here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Is that a good model? Like, what other types of regulations could exist?
Yeah, no. So we actually have a clear roadmap to what we can actually do. So you brought up the big one. So the cornerstone of all alcohol policy is availability. How do we reduce the availability, and how do we reduce access? So we look at that from a lot of different ways. So we can look at the days of selling alcohol, the hours of selling alcohol. So I'll give you two examples. So right now in Maryland, Governor Wes Moore, I believe his name. So I had no idea until I kind of like did this deep dive. Since 1978, there is a ban in Maryland grocery stores not sell wine or any like alcohol products whatsoever. And now with their new legislative session, Wes Moore's like, well, maybe we should like actually lift that ban and see what kind of happens. It's what the people want. He's saying, I'm putting people first by doing that. But what we know from public health strategy and from the policy analysis is that when you expand access and you get more alcohol in people's hands, more harm and injury is going to occur. And so that is.
We actually had a recent change here in Pennsylvania. Yeah. You can get canned cocktails now in more places than you used to be.
And I mean, my grocery store in my neighborhood, you can get alcohol. You have to go to a separate register, but you can get alcohol in the grocery store.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the other. So I'm from Texas. I was a cashier in our local grocery store. Texas has like weird kind of stipulations about when we can, like the days and the hours and everything. And there was this rule on Sundays that you couldn't buy, I believe it was like noon or like 10 o'clock. And that was always an eye opener for people that would be coming in like at 9 a.m. for all they would buy is like a single bottle of wine. And be like, you can't do that. And I'm like, oh, what do you mean? Like that realization, like I'm that person that I said I would never, you know, kind of become. And then like they actually put it back and they're like, okay, maybe I'll like take a step back and think about where I'm actually doing. Do I need this alcohol right now? In terms of the other things, we call it alcohol outlet density, meaning that the number of stores and places that are like licensed and permitted to actually sell alcohol, how many do we have like in one like zone?
Yeah.
Right. And so it's very interesting when you look at that. So of course, all these policies kind of disproportionately affect lower income communities.
Yes, because that's where you can find a lot of liquor stores and corner stores and all that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So like finding this was so hard.
Talking about the cigarette.
Yeah. Yes. But when you go to like West Philadelphia, for example, you have these bodegas and corner stores, like literally four at an intersection, right? Where you can, this is all access. But if we were able to just to take away maybe one, maybe two of those corner stores, I mean, that does a lot of good for the community.
Yeah. And I want to bring in another caller. We have Scout from Philadelphia who has a question or comment. Scout, you're on the line. You're on Studio 2.
Hi. Nice to talk to y'all. I just wanted to bring up, I guess, a comment on ways to reduce alcohol consumption in general by addressing the causes of people seeking out alcohol at such rates, utilizing strategies like your syntax to fund improving quality of life for the socioeconomic groups and people who are most affected by alcohol, which is predominantly dealing with a low quality of life. And as someone who is a former illicit substance user, I do not necessarily believe in, if we take it out of stores, people won't use it. Just as the way things function in the world, just because things are taken off the market legally does not mean the use stops. But when people's quality of life and urge to use it is reduced, we see better outcomes.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Scout.
Love that from Scout. Thank you, Scout.
Can we dig into this a little bit more? Because I was telling Avi before we started the show, my first drink was at First Communion. Yeah. You know, I sip.
It's so deep in our society.
It's deep in our, I mean, yeah. We, you know, you take a sip every day. I was raised Catholic. Take a sip of wine every Sunday. You think about all the celebrations. You drink, you know, you clink glasses. You drink at weddings. You drink, you know, all the time. And so how do we sort of like deal with that part of it? Because you think about the pushback that could come if you're trying to limit access, if you're trying to take it out the grocery stores when it took years to get it in. How do you sort of address the cultural components?
That's going to take years. It really is. So like y'all said, we celebrate with alcohol. We mourn with alcohol. And my God, if I don't have my margarita like on Taco Tuesday, like with my tacos, yeah. I'm going to flip this table, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just great. Like, this is part
but
of
don't the, flip the table. Oh, yeah.
We like this table.
But it's just crazy to think about like how ingrained it really, really is. And when you think about where we've, you know, we've saw what happened with, you know, alcohol, prohibition, right? It didn't stop alcohol. It did not stop drinking. It drove it out underground. We had a black market. We had speakeasies, you know, for example, where people can go and drink and have some sort of like refuge. But now once illicit refuge is now seen as something that like, oh, it's so trendy. It is so cool. But it's all about reframing the narrative of alcohol in general. And how do we actually go about doing that? And it comes from the targeted education and the awareness campaigns about the dangers. I took the L over from CHOP over here, and at the 34th Street platform, it was very interesting. Like, you just start seeing things when you start, like, you're in that mindset.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There was about 5 different tobacco, like, awareness things. Did you know that you can actually report to SEPTA? There's a line that you can call and report
someone for smoking.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
Well, let me actually, on that point, though, because people point to smoking and cigarettes as the model. We turn the tide on that, and that was very deeply ingrained in society. However, the thing about smoking, specifically smoking, not chewing tobacco, smoking, is that it impacts everyone around you. So there's this built-in constituency of people who are like, yeah, it kind of would be nice if people got rid of smoking. Alcohol doesn't work the same way in an environment. You know what I mean? If the guy next to me is having a drink, it doesn't, in most cases, it doesn't directly impact me. And that's where I'm a little skeptical that you could muster the political will the way you could with cigarettes. What do you think about that?
Yeah. I would also kind of push back on that a little bit. You know, it affects everyone around you. Alcohol does the exact same thing. And I speak to that mostly from my position and my perspective as a physician that just sees kind of the extremes, you know, of things as well. Yeah, sure. Like, me taking this right now, that's not going to do anyone harm, right? Well, actually, it might. I'm going to back to work, like, you know, right after this. But it is, we really just have to take a step back and think about what it does. Not because when we see
that is higher order thinking for people than this guy smoking next to me. I would love it if they banned it in this restaurant.
No, absolutely. Know? I mean, have you ever been on a plane where someone's been served too much? Like, you know,
sure,
absolutely,
sure. Yeah, sure. That's a disruption.
Yes,
for sure.
For sure.
We start hearing,
that's a good point.
Yeah, we start hearing about the community disruption as well. Drunk driving, you know, for example. Oh my God. So in Montgomery, Alabama, for example, they actually had a local ordinance that they were was going to be signed by the mayor, but then it got vetoed. And this ordinance was all about like going from like 2 a.m. to midnight about like reducing, like, we're going to stop sales of alcohol right here because they had a drunk driving problem. Mm. How are we going to do that? But then all of a sudden you had the beverage lobby, you had the public being like, you can't do that. We have to drink until 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get back? Like, this is like the thing where we have to all kind of come together.
Yeah. And I want to bring in another caller. We have Jamie from Elkins Park on the line. Jamie, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. I'm just listening to your observance about, like, you know, social spaces. We drink at weddings. We drink to go out. I think a lot of, you know, people who perceive themselves healthy pick up those drinking habits in adolescence and in college. And it comes from the sort of, like, lack of content of another social space. Like, now that I'm in my 30s, a lot of friends are comfortable being at home with their spouses and their babies. But how do you get content in a frat basement or a dingy bar? We already see, like, sober bars popping up.
Yeah.
But I guess question one is, like, what could a vision for doubling down on sober social spaces look like?
Mm.
And then is there any medical evidence that sort of supports, like, when you're a kid, you have fun sober all the time without thinking about it.
Yeah.
But as we get older and trained with alcohol, is there any medical evidence that, like, we don't know how to have fun as adults without a substance?
And Jamie, we're going to end it there because we're running out of
that's
time.
That's deep. That's so true. Yes. That's, you know, it enmeshes with everything. It's like how we have fun, yes. You know?
Yeah. And I can say I can have fun without alcohol, but there are people who get anxiety and they use it to make it a little bit easier.
Right?
Yeah. And I want to close out because we have the new administration coming in. We have Vivek Murthy, our Surgeon General, going out, right? Will this warning even happen? Does the Conservative Party, the GOP, do they care about this issue? Will this just fade away?
So I think I really appreciate the Surgeon General in making this advisory like warning, but I also think it came too late. Mm. I think we're going to have a missed opportunity. And I don't think that this next administration is going to make this a priority. And it's going to stay where it is right now at the state and the local level to kind of really kind of bring things up and
create
the
momentum.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. Before I say goodbye, I just want to read in a couple more Studio Tuber comments.
Mm-hmm.
Michelle says it's very interesting that liquor store staff were considered essential personnel during the pandemic. I think it speaks to the dangers of withdrawal for people who have a problem.
Exactly.
With drinking alcohol. Kelly says, I'm so confused. I also thought one glass of wine was good for the heart. If it was proven wrong, why didn't we know? Well, hopefully we're learning today. And Kelly says, is any form of alcohol better? And I think we're learning, no. There's not really like a healthy alcohol out there besides no alcohol. But let me thank our guests. Thank you so much, Luis Ceja, postdoctoral fellow with the National Clinician Scholars Program at the University of Pennsylvania. You were wonderful. You brought props. You brought energy. Luis, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Y'all want these?
Oh, gosh. Luis, don't tempt me.
We also want to say thank you to David Jernigan, who was on earlier on the show. He's a professor of health, law, policy, and management at Boston University, who joined us via Zoom. We appreciate your time as well. And we want to say thank you to you, our YouTubers who tuned in for our very first Studio 2 live stream. I'm so excited.
So excited.
Yeah. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Thank you. Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Before we go, Allie and Jamie said the incline in Pittsburgh should be on Pennsylvania's Seven Wonders list. I don't know much about it.
Look, but you know what?
I'll throw it on there.
I love our listeners because they let us know.
They let us
know.
And
I love that.
Shout out to Pittsburgh. Shout out to Philadelphia. We will be back tomorrow with more Studio 2.
See you then.